Okay, welcome everyone. And we're picking up where we ended last time because we're going to spend a bit more time, probably most of the time, we'll see, looking at more of the life of Jacob. And last time we were in Genesis 25. So if you want to find that now, because we're obviously moving on to 26, 27, and whatever. So in Genesis 25, we went through the bit where Jacob and Esau were born. The intense struggle within the mother's womb, and what happened when they emerged, and their names, and so on. And then the first bit of their story, where we ended up with Esau despising his birthright, basically being having in contempt, thought it was of no real importance at all. He much preferred some of that red stuff, which would satisfy his immediate hunger rather than have the long-term rights of the firstborn. So we're going to just pick up different bits of the story. We're going to really be in chapter 27 for quite a while. But as we get to the end of Genesis chapter 26, we learn about Esau's marriage. So in Genesis 26, verse 34, Esau marries when he is 40 years old. And then, having seemed to wait a long time, he decides to do two pretty quickly. And he ends up marrying two people. But both of them were a source of grief to Isaac and Rebekah. So his choice did not meet the parental approval. Why do you think that was? What was it about his choice of wife that they didn't like?
They weren't Hebrews.
Yes, indeed, and particularly they were Hittites. And in fact, just to jump ahead to the end of chapter 27, Rebekah expresses this in quite forceful terms. I'm disgusted with living because of these Hittite women. So let's just say these Hittites didn't hit it off with their mother-in-law and so on. And that was one of the reasons why Jacob had to make sure that he took a wife from amongst the Canaanites, basically. Sorry, from not amongst the Canaanites, but to go and find a wife from amongst the Hebrews. Anyway, in Genesis 27, we have got really quite a tough story, a very tricky one, because it involves things that ethically we might think are a little bit dodgy. And why on earth is this happening, given that this is the foundational part of God's whole story in terms of covenants to come and bringing the birth of Israel, the people of Israel, into the world? And also, of course, it's based on a culture that we don't understand too well about parental blessings and so on. We don't bother with all that. But it starts off beginning of Genesis 27 with Isaac being old and his eyes being weak. So this actually is the deception or the deceit of a blind old man, which does make the story have, as I said, certain sort of moral connotations, which we might want to think about. He calls for Esau, who actually replies with a very familiar, well, word, single word in Hebrew, at the end of verse one, when he says, "Here am I," which is just "Hineni." Can you remember anywhere earlier in Genesis where that phrase, "Here I am," or I suppose "Here am I" would do, but "Here I am," Hineni, occurs in a very sort of powerful context? You go back a few chapters, you'll see.
Wasn't it when the Lord called Abraham?
Yeah, a bit more specific. Called him what, where, when, how, why? Because God called him a lot. Mary? You've got your hand up, but you're silent still.
It's in chapter, it's in verse 11 of 22. But
Yeah,
the
in
angel
fact,
called him from heaven and said, "I am." And he said, "Here I am."
yeah, In fact, it's in Genesis 22 generally, because at the beginning of it, God tests Abraham by calling to him initially, verse 1, Abraham, and he says, Hineni, here I am.
Yeah.
And although it's maybe not been translated like that in your version, tell me if it does come through like that, but in verse 7, when Isaac says to his father, to his father Abraham, father, it tends to be translated, yes, my son, Abraham replied, but in fact, again, it is, here I am. Or to put it more poignantly, it's not just yes, it's I'm here. I'm right beside you. So that phrase gets used a lot. In fact, it's also, I think, the one that's used in Isaiah when Isaiah's call, here am I, send me. So it's a very common Hebrew phrase or word to basically sort of start off a conversation. Someone says, my son or name, and you say, here I am. Now, Isaac seems to be contemplating his demise. I'm now an old man, and he says something quite extraordinary. I don't know the day of my death. Well, come on, who does? I mean, that's not the greatest piece of wisdom, with, except it does show. Sorry, we're going to have to mute that. Okay. It does show that he was already thinking. He's an old man, and in some ways, his death is approaching. I wonder how accurate or correct he was in that. Do you know how old he was when he actually died? We've got an iPad in the waiting room. I'll just let it in, and we'll see if there's a person attached to it. So, any idea how old Isaac was when he actually... But can we keep that muted, please? Otherwise, yeah. Well, it's in chapter 35, so you have to move on quite a bit. My point is, he isn't really about to die. He may be beginning to think that he's getting that way. But in chapter 35, verse 29... Okay, I don't know what's happening here. Can we not permanently mute that, Christine? Every time I mute it, it goes unmute. Can you give an eye on that?
It was 180.
It was 180, yes, that's right, yes. I was trying not to say it as a dance commentator, but you nearly caught me out there. Yes, I've been distracted to actually trying to find it myself, to be honest, but there we are. Okay. It's verse 28, I think it said 29, but it says Isaac lived 180 years, then he breathed his last. So he may at this point have been feeling, you know, as though he's getting on a bit decrepit, but actually he's not really about to die, but he is at this point weak of eyes, as I think it might actually say. So what does he want to do at this point? Well, firstly, he seems to want some good food again. Because Esau is the hunter, and I think we said in the previous time that he had a taste for he had hunting in his mouth. He really enjoyed what it was that Esau could do, and the idea is if the son would feed the father would bless the son, and the way it's expressed in verse 4, I don't know whether anyone else has got a good translation of this towards the end. May I that I may give you my blessing before I die. It's actually, I will give you my innermost blessing. I will bless you from the very depths of my being, or my soul will bless you. That's how the end of verse 4 actually reads. Does anyone else have any translation on that to highlight that?
Yeah, that my soul may bless you before I die.
Yeah, okay. Malcolm, have you got anything extra to add on that?
Yeah, the CJB says, make it tasty the way I like it and bring it to me to eat. Then I will bless you as firstborn before I die.
Well, okay, yeah. That's not quite in the translation because as we're saying, that it's a tivarek nafshin or nefesh. It's to do with the soul. So I think that brings about the firstborn is put in there because although it's true, it's not technically in the actual translation of it.
No, but it is actually the blessing of the firstborn.
Yes, that's what he wants to do. Yes, yes, yeah, yeah. It will be.
The blessing for the firstborn is, you know, as when in a will the oldest son gets double portion.
That was eventually the case. Yes, we said last time we're not sure when that came in, whether that was already the point. But yes, there was a special, different blessing for the firstborn. So you're right, but it's just not there in the actual words. Anyway, the story takes a twist because someone is listening in. Someone is overhearing this, whether by chance or by design, we don't know. So if you're not familiar with the story, read on from verse 5 onwards. I suppose for up to about 17, really. Verses 5 to 17 is really all about Rebecca. And what you've got to try and decide is, was she doing something good or was she doing something bad? How would you interpret that, verses 5 to 17, in terms of, shall we say, moral right or wrong? Just give you a moment to pick up the details of that and see if you can come to a conclusion on that. Okay, is it Rose or John at this point? Do you want to come in now?
Yes, I'm grateful to God he didn't make me judge.
Okay. Okay, thank you for that bit of fence sitting there. Yes, very good. as usual, you probably guessed the sort of answer I'm going to give, but I wanted you to come up with an idea yourself. Is anybody going to come on with them, Malcolm? Yeah?
Well, Rivka, when the babes were, you know, the twins were in her womb, they were fighting, and the Lord told her then that the older would serve the younger.
So you think she was obeying God's will, and therefore that's good?
Yeah, and yeah. I think there was a little bit of personal thing in it as well.
Ah, right, mixed motives, that sort of thing. Yeah, okay. Well, anyone else want to comment on the morality of this story from that point of view?
I just felt that she was trying to help God out, which is never a good thing to do.
Right. Do you think that she had really thought through the consequences of this? Because almost like the moment that she heard what was going to happen, she sort of leaps into action, gets hold of Jacob. If you remember, we found back in chapter 25, verse 28, that Isaac loved Esau, but Rebekah loved Jacob, and loved being first choice. So there was this parental battle over which was the preferred child. So maybe that came into it. We've got Mary first. Mary?
Yeah, I was just thinking she should have trusted God. Because she knew that's what God was going to do.
Yeah.
Yeah, like you said earlier, she was giving God a hand.
Does that remind you of a similar story where someone decided that we better give God a hand?
Abraham.
And in particular with... and Hagar.
Yeah,
exactly. There's so many repeated patterns within the Genesis stories. The different families all seem to go through the same sort of things, that we're sort of getting used to some of this now. But the story itself doesn't express a judgment on this. It doesn't tell us what to think. There's no hints, I don't think. It doesn't steer us one way or the other about whether what she was doing really was morally good or not. But anyway, she's determined that the son that she loves isn't going to miss out here. So she has then this plan, probably already sort of prepared, that they're going to sort of swap places. What's Jacob's reaction to this when eventually he realizes that his mother is about to do all this?
Confusion.
Yeah. Okay. Anything else? Donna Rose?
He's afraid of it. Sorry, Mary, go on.
Sorry, he didn't want to do it.
Yeah.
I understood it. He was questioning what he was told by his mother.
And any particular reason?
I think he's afraid of being caught out.
Exactly. Basically, it was, this isn't going to work. You know, like, haven't you realised that we're a bit different to us two? We're not identical twins. One of us is hairy and one of us is unhairy, like that, something smooth. And as part of this blessing, or part of the whole thing that's going to happen, Isaac is inevitably going to touch in some way. There will be, whether it's, you know, just stroking, caressing, whatever, but a father-son sort of thing. Touch is going to let me down. You can deceive his eyes. We can maybe, you know, work on the voice and all that sort of thing. But we've got a really big problem with the idea of what if my father touches him? And then what's his real fear in that verse 12?
He'll get a curse instead of a blessing.
Absolutely, the very opposite. So he's really saying to his mum, if you like, have you thought this through? Are you really sure? And of course, his mum's reply is astonishing. And whether that helps us to decide what she's really like, she says, just, I'll take the curse for you. Just do what I say. Verse 14, off he goes. And it all happens in the way that she says. So we've got another situation with Jacob having a dish of food in the same sort of way as we had at the end of the last chapter when he was, you know, making his stew and so on. In verse 13 onwards, 14 and so on, there he is with his dish of food. Verse 19, Jacob now has to lie. Because now he's committed to it at this point. You've got to imagine him there. He's been dressed up in the clothes. He's got everything he needs. And the moment he's dreading is, who is it? Which one are you? And it's an out-and-out lie that he says. And when Isaac questions him, how did you manage to do this so quickly? In other words, he didn't expect, if Esau was going out hunting, you'd have to catch something, prepare it, and so on. And all this now seems to have happened quickly because Rebecca's got to get in first with this. Isaac's response, what do you make of Isaac's response in verse 20?
He was very quick to think the answer up.
Yeah, but tell me more about...
You haven't had time to go out and catch something and kill skin it,
but
prepare it, cook it.
Yeah, but what did he say? What were the words that he used? How did he...
find it so quickly.
Yeah, what was his answer?
The Lord, your God, gave me success.
Exactly. Firstly, he brings God into it. But he doesn't say the Lord my God. He says the Lord your God gave me success. That's an even bigger lie because he's bringing God into it. You know, it's sort of getting worse. It's like once you head down this little road of deceit, you know, the web gets sort of tighter and tighter. And we know that this is really Jacob's character, amazingly, the one that God has chosen is going to use. And looking a long way ahead, but you know how it all works out. This is going to come back to him. He's going to receive what he's given out when he is deceived later on. Just remind us, what's the main way that Jacob himself was going to be deceived?
When he gets married, Leah instead of Rachel.
Exactly. Another case of two people. Instead of it being one, it's the other. And I think it says, looking ahead, thinking ahead. He doesn't work it out until the next morning, does he? Yeah. I think it's this wonderful way it's put. Sort of wakes up next morning, and oh, it was it was Leah. So he gets deceived in a very similar sort of way, doesn't he, John?
Yeah, it's about the eyes not seeing.
Yes,
Jacob didn't see it.
Yes. So if we talk about Isaac's eyes being weak, Jacob, in his own way, was not seeing what was going on. Yeah. John and Jan.
Isaac must have had a big appetite, wanting two goats.
Okay.
Or was it that Rebecca needed two goats to cover his arms?
Oh, yes, it's the goat skins. It's the goat skins. I wonder where we're getting the two goats from.
Yeah, they were kids, not goats, not grown-up goats.
Right. Bring me two. This is verse 9 you've gone back to, isn't it? Bring me two choice young goats. But I suppose the idea is that the food would come from the goat as well as the goat skin. But okay. Maybe he did have a good appetite. Maybe he really liked his goat. And has anyone ever eaten goat, by the way? Anyone experienced the great delight of eating goat? No, you have.
Yes, what was it like? I have.
What was it like then? Someone tell me what it's like to eat goat.
Lamb.
70 years ago when I had it.
Yeah.
It's like lamb.
It's
isn't
like
it?
Lamb.
Yeah.
Not like chicken.
More
then.
Gamey than lamb.
It's. You think so? I thought it was very similar to lamb.
Okay. Well, who knows? It maybe. But at least if it's choice young goats, it's probably not so bad. They're probably young and tender. And the best bits of them. But I think some bits of goat are not the most nutritious things to eat. Not that I've experienced it a great deal, but I never thought that I would want to do that. Anyway, the blessing actually follows then, after there was yet another lie, moving on to verse 24 and so on. Are you really my son, Isaac? Yes, I am. Yes, I am. And eventually, because of the way the deception's worked out, it catches him out, and then he blesses him. So in verse 27 onwards, look at that blessing. Is there a way of sort of summarizing it? What actually does Isaac say at this particular point? Yeah, what would you say there?
It's virtually the same. Same thing that God says to Abram in Genesis 12:3.
Yes, there is a lot of similarities there. Yeah.
And repeating what Rebecca had been told that the brothers would bow down to
him. Right. Yeah. So it's a nice blessing to get. You'd be very happy with your father saying these things to you. Yeah. It's sort of like promising a nice life.
It's a poison.
What else we got, John and Jan? John and Jan?
Yeah, I was struck that Esau is the one that has the animals, is the farmer. Jacob is the vegetable grower. Is that the right way around? The blessing is for vegetables, grain and new wine.
Okay.
Not for stock.
Yeah. Okay. Interesting. Good point. Thank you. Mary?
I just think the bit at the end, like your mother's sons bow down to you, that reminds me of Joseph. In the dream where his brothers had to bow down to him.
Yeah. Okay.
I don't know if there's any connection, not really.
Well, we might see eventually, but there's lots of nice things in there, isn't it? You know, you won't have to work too hard. Everything will be provided fairly easily. God will bless you and so on. Malcolm?
I have a question there on verse 29 where it says, cursed be everyone who curses you and blessed be everyone who blesses you. Now, in Genesis 12:3, where it says a very similar thing, the Lord says to Abraham, the two words for bless are the same, but the two words for curse are two different words in Genesis 12:3.
They are,
Same here.
Yeah, okay. Good. Which matches it up, so. Anyway, it seems as though he's got a nice sort of outcome here. It will all be nice and easy for him. You'll sort of get rich without much effort and so on. The question is, because he's stealing this blessing, because it really isn't his, it wasn't meant for him directly, it was because he thought it was Esau, does that mean this blessing would therefore come true or not? How much of this do you think actually comes true? We really say, yes, it is God blessing Jacob, or actually, because it's not meant for Jacob, it doesn't actually come true. Any thoughts on that?
He really did not have an easy life at all.
No.
And he thought he had lost his favourite son. And he was beside himself with grief.
So that's much, much later on, yes. Yeah. Indeed.
So no. I don't think these things... he was blessed in some ways, but he had a hard time of it.
He did indeed. And of course, it all starts really with him having to work hard for Laban for 7 years and then another 7 years.
Yeah.
And all the time, it's as though he was perhaps trying to make this blessing work, but it was never intended for him. So you can't make it work in that sense. If anything, he's going to be sent back. As we'll see a little bit later on, he has to flee. So he ends up back in Haran with Laban. Now, what do we know about Haran and where Laban was? I mean, it goes backwards in the journey to where Abraham had come from when he was coming out of that. It's almost as though he has to, a bit of snakes and ladders going on here, if you like, he has to go back down, slide back down before God can really start to use him. Let's just jump ahead to chapter 28, because in chapter 28 and verses 3 and 4, you get the real blessing of Isaac for Jacob. Okay, so that was the false blessing, the stolen blessing. But in chapter 28, Isaac called for Jacob and blessed him, told him not to marry a Canaanite, but go and get a wife from amongst the daughters of Laban, your own family. But then in verse 3, you get here a blessing where it starts off, may God Almighty bless you. And God Almighty is the Shaddai blessing, the El Shaddai. As though it's sort of even more so, the God of provision and protection and so on. May he bless you, make you fruitful and increase your numbers until you become a community of peoples. That seems to work. In fact, is there a reminiscence about that blessing in chapter 28 then, about being fruitful and increasing your numbers until you become a community and so on? Can you resonate anything with that one?
Was it in Genesis chapter 3 with Abraham?
Chapter 3 with Abraham? What was chapter 3 with Abraham?
When God says to Abraham, I'll make you multiply you.
Okay, but that won't be chapter 3, but later. But actually, If you go back earlier, it resonates with the very first instruction to Adam, isn't it? Adam and Eve.
Yeah.
In chapter 1, God blessed them and said to them, be fruitful and increase, fill the earth and subdue it, and so on. So that seems to be a blessing more in line with the original one and, yes, Abraham, and so on. This seems to be the more, shall we say, the more covenantal one, which is God's true blessing that he wants to give to the patriarchs, which is always to do not with just, not with ruling over others, not with lots of wealth, not with the get rich quick sort of thing, but with land and people. This seems to be a proper blessing on that. Anyway, just perhaps to go back to complete the chapter 27 story, Isaac gets this blessing, and then immediately Esau comes in and the game's up. Sorry, that was a pun on the word game there, because of the food. Actually, no, it wasn't. I just realised. So anyway, the game is up, because in comes Esau with his game. And at that point, Isaac trembles violently in verse 33 as they realize what he's done. Esau bursts out with a loud and bitter cry, and all this happy family stuff goes pear-shaped yet again. Mary?
One thing occurred to me. I don't equate goats with game.
Oh, you don't equate goats with game?
No.
No, that's a good point. Okay.
No, but they're more gamey than sheep. So they would be the best thing other than trying to catch a gazelle or something that Rebecca wouldn't have had to hand.
Yeah, thank you.
She would have had a goat to hand.
Yeah.
Okay. So and it was more deception.
Yeah, it is. It's the closest that they could get to that. So, yes, it doesn't look like Esau comes in with more goats. He's actually got the real stuff. But perhaps part of what Rebecca did was to make a good sauce to go with it, to sort of cover up the goaty thing and make it a bit more gamey. I'm guessing here, of course, because my skills in the kitchen are non-existent. But anyway. Esau realised what he's lost, and he asked for a blessing as well. And I think basically Isaac has to say, I can't take it back. I can't take back the blessing. But he does at least say in verse 39 to Esau, well, I can give you this blessing instead. The verses 39 and 40 may not sound much of a nice thing to hear, but that was left for him. But the outcome, of course, of all this is from this day onwards, Esau holds a grudge against Jacob. And that's going to run and run through the whole story. And therefore, nice phrase in verse 42, your brother Esau is consoling himself with the thought of killing you. So, you know, he's really upset. He's in a really bitter sort of state. He's holding this grudge and he decides, the best way to console myself is to go out and kill him. So Jacob has to flee. All of this within God's provision, presumably. And so now Jacob begins his wandering, his journey backwards, as I say, towards Haran, back towards the ancestors in the past. But at least that way he's going to meet his wife and so on. So he has a dream. We need to look at his dream, I think. You can't look at the life of Jacob without something to do with the dream. So we've got to chapter 28 and verse 10, moving on pretty well towards the end of the chapter.
Sorry, yeah. Paul.
Yeah, fine.
I was just thinking, you looked at verses 1 to 3 of Genesis 28, but actually verse 4 is most interesting.
Yeah.
And give you the blessing of Abraham.
Yeah, yeah.
Maybe, as somebody said, that Rebecca maybe jumped the gun and didn't need to have done what, that actually Isaac was going to do that anyway. But we don't know, of course.
Yeah, I can't quite work out the timing of all this anyway, how quickly perhaps these events really moved on apace once it got going. Because I don't think also it says really from chapter 27, how old Jacob and Esau are at this point. We've had the previous bit about Esau being 40 years old and gets married, but, you know, that may not be a time marker. That just might be that happened at some point, presumably before this, but how old were Jacob and Esau during chapter 27? It's not totally clear. But yeah, thanks for bringing that extra bit in. I did skip over the rest of that blessing. That was more the blessing that he should have had because it was linked into the covenants and so on. Anyway, he has to set out on quite a long journey. He leaves Beersheba, which you probably know is in the south, all the way back to Haran, which is in the north. And as part of that long journey, he has to obviously break the journey for the night and eventually stop somewhere because it's getting dark. We had a hand up. It's gone down again. Does anyone want to say anything? I saw a hand go up.
I was thinking chapter 28, Becca again connived to get Jacob a blessing.
Yeah.
Telling Jacob, flee at once. And then sort of, Isaac, I'm disgusted with those Hittite women. Send Jacob with a blessing to my brother.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. Yeah, maybe she's still working out her little plot on all this. But he's on the run, and he ends up at a place which there's no... one word to keep looking out for in these verses is the word place. It says he reached a certain place. Basically, he didn't know where he was. It didn't have a name. He just had to stop there because the sun had now gone down. And time and again, you will find the word place, place, place. I think altogether about, we see later on, pick it up at verse 16, where it occurs a lot. Jacob awoke from his sleep. He said, surely the Lord is in this place. And he says, how awesome is this place? And then it gets a name later on. But to start with, it's just a place, an anonymous sort of place. So in other words, he hadn't arrived at somewhere where something unusual was expected, but it's going to end up being a key place from now on. So he has a dream. Now, I wonder what your version says about that. We all know it's Jacob's ladder. My version has got stairway. So that's verse 12. Do we have any other ways of describing this, and if so, what do we really think it looked like, or it might have looked like? He had a dream in which he saw something resting on the earth with its top reaching to heaven, etc., etc. Stairway, ladder, anything else, or what do you think it actually might have been like? Malcolm.
Well, it must have been some ladder because the angels were going up and down on it.
Yeah. There's not a lot of room on a ladder if to go up and down at the same time, is there? If that's what you're saying. Yeah. Yeah. I think we've got to get out of our minds our standard sort of wooden ladder or metal ladder even. It won't have looked like whatever it was. So maybe stairway is better. Staircase. Any other versions or options in footnotes or commentaries or anything? Because one suggestion I've come across is it was almost like a hillside with steps, almost like, you know, you get these pyramids, the ziggurats they're called in the ancient Near East, where the sides are stepped. But so whatever it was obviously big enough, tall enough, and as well as wide enough to have lots of, shall we say, activity going on it. So maybe ladder isn't the best. Stairway might do, but maybe it's difficult to quite translate what it looked like. Obviously, some kind of slope with some kind of stepped means on it. Not, of course, that angels really need any kind of steps or stairways in order to go up and down, should they so wish. It was obviously to create an impression. So what's the impression meant to be then when you, if ever you have a dream and you see lots of angels going up and down a stairway, does it convey anything, do you think? What was he meant to get out of that? Karen, you got your hand up, Karen?
Yeah, that was for the thing. Mine said stair like pavement, but mine said stair like pavement, but we've moved on. But is it the ministry of the angels that, you know, were to go between earth and heaven? And
And therefore, I think it's saying that. God is involved in, he's not just up there in heaven, there is traffic, if you like, between heaven and earth. And it's to give an impression of what God is like, and that although he is, as always, he has to be remote, he has to be different and so on, it's not in a disinterested sort of way. It's meant to make, I think, Jacob more aware that God is actually watching over him and interested in him. And it's almost like his angels are there to guard you and look after you and so on in a particular way. Malcolm, I think, and then I had another hand up. But Malcolm?
Maureen had a hand up. What I'm thinking is that the angels would be bringing down blessings from the Lord to the people.
Yeah.
Taking back the blessings and praises of the people back to the Lord.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Anything else, Maureen? You're muted, though, if you want to say something.
Sorry about that. I've got in the footnote of my Bible, and it's John, chapter 1, verse 51.
Yeah.
And it says, and he said to them, I am telling you the truth. You will see heaven open and God's angels going up and coming down on the Son of Man. I've got in my...
Yeah, that's Jesus speaking to, I think, is it Nathaniel? Yeah?
Yes.
Yeah. So, and I think there's, as always with Jesus, there's a deliberate sort of hint back to like Jacob's ladder. But it's obviously now putting Jesus himself as the main link between heaven and earth. You know, whatever it was like in the past, it's even better now because it's Jesus himself who is, shall we say, conducting the traffic or organizing the toing and froing and so on. So angels are involved at this point. And I was going to say something really interesting and profound, but I can't find the verse, which is annoying, or at least the verse that I've written down doesn't seem to be the right one. So I was going to say, there was another time when angels appeared dramatically on the scene. I think I'm finding it. It's somewhere, I think it's in chapter 32, but for some reason I don't have an accurate verse. What I was going to suggest, surely there is something I guess. If you see it, help me out. But I think angels are meeting him now when he's leaving the land. But angels, he also has another dream or experience of them when he's coming back on the way to meet Esau.
The first verse of chapter 32, angels met him.
It was so much at the beginning, I skipped past it so quickly. Yes, that's it. Thank you. So chapter 32, verse 1. So Jacob is on his way. So where is he on his way now? He's on his way back because he's now going to meet Esau, the crunch meeting, which we'll probably get to next week at this rate. But angels appear again. And for those who like this sort of thing, it's a sort of literary device that, that it acts as sort of the beginning and the end of a whole stack of stories, which are sort of binding it all together. This is Jacob in exile, basically. He's on the run. He will one day come back. But at this point, there's angels at the beginning, and perhaps he gets something from that that will help him, a sort of a memory to take with him in the years to come. And then angels are there again as he comes back, once he's preparing to actually meet up with Esau. But in the meantime, back in chapter 28, what he gets a lot out of this dream, this vision, because actually the Lord is there as well. He hears things from God. So this is no longer just the blessing of a human father. This is God himself saying, the God of your father and of Isaac. Interesting, eventually God is going to be the God of Abraham, Isaac and Jacob. The moment he is the God of Abraham and Isaac and not quite Jacob yet. It's on the way. But what God promises, of course, which was probably an absolute surprise to him, that God is saying, I'm going to give you and your descendants the land. Your descendants like will be like the dust of the earth. And here we go again, all the Abrahamic promises of an immeasurable number of children and the land to come and so on. But whereas, in a sense, this happens in a dream. Jacob, again, is passive. He's not involved in this at all. He's receiving something he's going to sort of work on the basis of that from now on. When he awakes from his sleep, he's got that ringing in his head, if you like, but it's not as though he was expecting it. It was a dramatic intervention by God. And there, if you like, is the real blessing that God always intended, never mind all the human interference and so on. I will give you and your descendants the land. Your descendants were like dust of the earth. That reference to earth again, to Adamar, going back to Adam. You're spread out in all directions. All the peoples on earth will be blessed through you. There it is again. I am with you, will watch over you. That's the angel sort of bit of it again. I will bring you back. Okay, I will bring you back. And when you do come back, there'll be angels there again to confirm it. I will not leave you until I've done what I've promised you. So that's a tremendous thing to hear, to receive at this time when he's really, a lot of it's in the future, but that was because he wasn't an Esau who just wanted his grub now and satisfy me now. He was going to be taken on this very awkward, difficult journey, and he needed this promise at this point. And it's like God always works out his promises through longer periods of difficulty and so on. It wasn't going to be a nice, easy sort of thing for him. But when he woke up, he was certainly aware that God had been there, and he was afraid, and he said, how awesome it is. This, if this is the gateway to heaven, then it must be the house of God. And therefore, that place is called Bethel or Bethel. And then you are told, verse 19, it used to be called, I'm going to pronounce it Luz, but Luz, I think that might be pronounced like that. Any idea what that name means? What it used to be called, what that actually means?
Light.
Light, that's right. Who actually called it that? He doesn't say, but it's now forever going to be associated with Bethel. And Jacob's response is, again, quite a typical one. He wants to set up a memorial. He uses the stones because he'd used one as a pillow, which wasn't very, helpful and exciting for him. But he leaves them behind as a sort of memorial, which is very common. And then he makes a vow. Then he makes a vow back to God. If God will be with me and will watch over me, et cetera, et cetera, then the Lord will be my God is the essence of that. The Lord will be my God. Because then we get in those days, everybody had gods It's a matter of which God you actually had. Who was your chosen one? Who was your family idol or your national one or whatever? And at this point, he's fully committing to the Lord as his God. And therefore, God will be able to rename himself the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob in due course. Malcolm?
I'm going back to verse 19.
Yeah.
Up until that point, one has the impression that he's somewhere out in the country where he stopped asleep.
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden, he's called the place Beit El, but the town had originally been called Luz. Where's the town suddenly come from?
Exactly, yeah. Because as I said, it was just called a place, place, place. And I suppose he was certainly on his own, by the looks of it, otherwise he wouldn't have suddenly sat down there. But maybe it was nearby. But yeah, I take the point that there's this sudden extra description of it, which we wouldn't have been anticipating. So I can't answer that anymore. But Mary?
One would have thought that if he was near a town, he would have gone there looking for a combination.
Yeah, you would. I take the point. Yeah, fine. Mary, though, and then John, I think.
Yeah, my version says that city. So a city.
Yeah.
But something real bigger than a town.
Yeah, something substantial, definitely. So I don't know. I mean, it says early the next morning, he took the stone and he did all that. And so that must have happened where he slept overnight, and he called that place. I thought he didn't move on to the nearest city and then discovered, oh, that's fine, I was just outside in this place called Lutz, I'll rename it Bethel. He seems to have called that place Bethel, House of God, but it is a bit strange. So, yeah, we've got John first and then John next.
In my Bible, which is the Amplified, it describes the place Luz as meaning almond tree.
Oh. Almond tree. Okay, so we're now saying that there just happened to be a tree nearby, not a full city. Okay. Good point, don't know. John, help us out again.
It just say the city of Luz.
Yeah.
But Luz meant almond tree.
Oh, okay. I thought it meant light, actually, but maybe that's, as always, is probably more.
If Jacob was kind of, you know, he'd set off on his own and he'd kept walking, as it were, until, well, he just kept walking. And in those days, they would close up the gates of the city at sunset.
Yeah.
So he might have been walking. I mean, this is kind of conjecture, but he might have been walking along. And at that point, even if he'd seen the city, he couldn't get in. And therefore, he was sleeping out rough.
It does say he stopped for the night because the sun had set.
Yeah.
As though he just missed out there.
Although he might have been afraid to go into the city as well.
Yes. And of course, he was on his own, which is unusual, really. So this was quite a journey that he was going. Presumably totally on his own. I think we'd know if there's other people there. Mary?
What do you make of the vow that Jacob made? If God will be with me and keep me in this way and give me bread and clothes so that I come back to my father's house, then the Lord shall be my God. But it's a strange vow. It's like testing God in a way.
Yeah, I see what you mean. That's our usual way of an if and then, isn't it? I mean, but it could be that the if's a funny word. It can be used in that way, but it can also mean if and it will, or if and I will, or something. It doesn't have to have an uncertainty about it. He could almost be saying, okay, God, you said this, so if you do this, fine. And you are going to do this, and then I will, meaning I will anyway. Go on.
But God had already promised he would.
Yeah, I know.
So why would he say, if you do?
I know, I take exactly what you're saying. And in English, that's the way you would probably think, oh, he's being a bit sort of iffy about this. no pun intended again, you know, does he really accept it or not? But sometimes, and I don't know whether this is in the Hebrew, whether this is the way the Hebrew mind works, it's not something I've come across, but sometimes when you say if, you don't mean if and it might not, you mean if and it definitely will. And then you follow it up with your own and I definitely will. It's just, it almost becomes a figure of speech rather than a matter of doubt. But right. I'm thinking that through as I'm saying it rather than I know that. But yeah, it is a good point. And he promises to give him a tenth as well. He binds himself to God by saying he'll give a tenth, because at the moment he's got very little. So, I notice he's got some oil with him. I don't know why he's been carrying that around, but he pours some oil on top of the stone that he sets up. So perhaps he had a bit of a backpack with him on his journey. Anyway, he continues his journey in chapter 29, and he turns up at a well. I wonder how much further he's got. Presumably sufficiently far, because they must be near to Haran now. So several days might have gone there. And then he continued, probably his several more days' journey. And he comes to the well, and suddenly he is his life is going to be transformed. He's got quite close now to Laban's house and land. And Rachel comes at this time with her sheep, all nicely arranged by God, so that God's next plan can come into play. I want to move through this a little bit. We've got time. Let's keep going. Okay, there's this so-called chance meeting, but it isn't. It's all arranged by God, that he meets Rachel, realizes that she really is part of the family, that she was a daughter of Laban. So he helps her out, he rolls the stone away, and so on, and basically says, I'm a relative, and back he goes to Laban. And you get a very sort of nice, homely, family sort of set up in verse 13 onwards, that Laban hears the news about Jacob, a relative. He hurries to meet him. He embraces him, kisses him, and brings him to his home. A little bit of a sort of, not quite a prodigal son in this case, but almost like a long lost relative being, you know, had him running out to meet him, embracing him, bringing him back to his home. You are my own flesh and blood, which was a very nice, typical Middle Eastern welcome to say, you are my own flesh and blood. Very similar to Adam recognizing Eve as being, bone of my bone, flesh of my flesh, and that sort of thing. Saying, you know, we really do belong together, we're that close. So it all sounds lovely. But we know this is the beginning of the next bit of sort of trickery. I'm looking for the word love in all this now. So this is moving on. Jacob's now staying with Laban. You're a relative of mine. Should you work for me for nothing, I'll give you some wages and so on. And then he meets the two daughters. And in verse 18, it says Jacob was in love with Rachel. Okay, Jacob loved Rachel. And I think we're going to have three mentions of his love. And I found one, verse 18. Verse 20, because of his love for her. And I'm sure somewhere there is another one. Perhaps I've gone past it. Oh, that's right. In verse 30, and he loved Rachel more than Leah and so on. Okay, so I found it. Three times there is the reference to Jacob loving Rachel. Okay. How many times did Abraham love Sarah? You're not going to know the answer to this, don't worry. It's one of those questions that I don't answer. Basically, none. Nowhere does it ever say that Abraham loved Sarah. I'm not saying he didn't, it's just not recorded. Apparently once, and don't ask me where, only once does it say that Isaac loved Rebecca. But three times it says that Jacob loved Rachel. Later on, it will say the same sort of thing between Jacob and Joseph as well. But love is, it's not a common word used, and it's not like sort of used a lot within the sort of, what I think of as the romantic relationships. But love is really to do with choice. And it's to do with not just feelings, but with a whole attitude towards what's going on. So he's prepared to work 7 years, but it seemed only like a few days because of his love for her. That's stronger than any previous loves that we've come across in Genesis so far. So there's something particularly special about that. But then, as we said, the deceiver is deceived. And the next morning, verse 25, there was Leah. Now, don't ask me how all that happens. I can try and sort of have some idea about them being veiled and it was dark in the tent or whatever. But the next morning, he gets this huge shock with the phrase, "Why have you deceived me?" Laban is just as much a trickster as Jacob was, in that sense. And out comes the reason. Well, you know, we don't give our youngest one in marriage first. So you're stuck with this, but you can still have Rachel as well. But another 7 years, please. Another 7 years of work. And he was prepared to do that. So after his honeymoon of one bridal week, he goes back to work in order to gain the one that he really loves. Now, you may have heard me say something like this before, but this phrase in verse 30, "He loved Rachel more than Leah," does not mean that Leah wasn't loved. Okay, we must make that quite clear. It'll come up again in a minute. But the idea of loving one person more than another just means that you put them first. It doesn't mean you hate someone. It doesn't mean doesn't have any love at all. So verse 31, when it says the Lord saw that Leah was not loved, don't think that as meaning there was no love at all, or it was, you know, sort of he hated her in some way, or he just had nothing for feelings. It just means that there was a preference going on here, which is bad enough, really, in that sense, isn't it? That they had to put up with that situation. It's almost like, you know, you can't serve two masters because you're bound to prefer one to the other. It just doesn't work. So this is an example of it not working within a marriage. Oh, good. Lots of comments. Mary first and then John, I think.
Some years ago, I had a teaching on this, and Esau was supposed to have married Leah. And this is what the teaching was. And Jacob was to get Rachel anyway. But of course, Esau displeased his parents and married Hittite woman, I think it said.
Right. Where did you get all that from?
I don't know. I read it years ago in some teaching that I heard. That Leah was to be Esau's bride.
But they're not in the same part of the world, are they?
I know, but that was the plan.
But whose plan? And how would that come about?
Well, Esau wasn't supposed to marry Hittites. He was supposed to marry from his father, from the...
Okay, you mean like an arranged marriage. That's the way it should have happened.
That's right.
But Esau should have gone back as well to the family
and
origins.
Married the elder daughter.
I see. Okay. I see where that's coming from now. But okay, he didn't because he married his dad as well. Yeah. Okay.
the conjecture, but I read yeah. that. I thought it was interesting.
Well, yeah, you do get that, particularly if it was a Jewish sort of teaching or based upon Jewish traditions and understandings, that something does come out. I just couldn't make it work, but I see what you're saying, that that almost long time in the past, that was the plan. In which case then, presumably part of the same plan would have been that Jacob ended up with Rachel anyway. It's happened in a very long-winded and sort of strange sort of way.
Might have been a sort of disappointment for Laban and his family that Esau didn't fulfill what he was supposed to do.
Okay, so explaining why he decided to do what he did and get his own back a little. He probably felt let down by the fact that Esau hadn't come. Okay, very interesting. Thank you.
Yeah.
So we got John.
Yeah, interesting thing from Mary there. And it, culturally, it kind of makes sense too.
So, yeah.
But that wasn't what I was going to say. In verse 28, it looks to me like... well, in the previous verses, actually, Jacob had two wives in 2 weeks. He doesn't have to wait another 7 years for Rachel to become his wife.
You see what you mean. He still has to work for her, but...
He's still got to work for her, but he gets her immediately.
Yeah, that's verse 29. He finished the week with Leah, and then Laban gave him his... Yeah. I haven't thought of that before. That's one of the strange things, that suddenly you read it differently and you think, oh, he had to work the same. Okay. And that would satisfy everybody, I suppose, wouldn't it? Laban's done it in the right order, according to him. Jacob is fine, eventually. but he's also part of the deal. He stays with Laban for another 7 years. Okay. But also,
it explains how all the rest of the rigmarole about the sheep and the bits of sticks in the water and all the rest of it happens over a number of following years, and kids keep arriving or don't, as the case may be.
Okay. Oh right, thanks. So I hadn't seen that before. He finished his week with and then Laban gave him his daughter. But you also notice that other women are involved, maidservants, or dare we call them concubines, perhaps, in that sense. So we get Bilhah. I'm sure there's someone else eventually, because we're coming at last to the point where there's going to be lots and lots of sons to different people in different orders. Have you ever decided that you ought to learn the sons of Jacob in order and know exactly who the mother is? I must admit, I'm not sure I have, but shall we go through it now? So Leah becomes pregnant first, and we get Reuben, the firstborn. Now, all these names are interesting, aren't they? Have you got footnotes to help you what it means? Reuben, I've got my footnote. He has seen my misery or poverty. Great name to give your first son there. I suppose it's okay because it's the Lord has blessed me in this way with him because of my misery and poverty. So that's child number one, Reuben. So he's going to be... the firstborn, if you like, the main son, and yet in the end he isn't, when we follow the whole story of the family through. Next one is Simeon, whose name means because the Lord has heard me. And then you get Levi, which my footnote tells me means, well, attached, is that right? Or company.
Adjoining,
yes, attached or accompanying, yes. And then number four, Judah. And of course, I think we all know that that means praise, which is going to be the main name or the main tribe eventually. So there we are. We've got four sons born, all to Leah at this point, because God has chosen to bless Leah first. I know you think there might be a bit of a competition going on here, because you get to the next chapter, that Rachel at this point isn't getting anywhere with the childbearing thing, and she becomes jealous. And what happens then? Oh, use the maidservant. She can give me children through her. So the next children to appear are Dan, but not from Rachel, from Bilhah, and then Naphtali. Okay, so we've got two more arriving. Dan meaning something like God has vindicated me, and Naphtali to do with struggle, or basically I had a bit of a struggle with my sister on this. So that's the next two that's arrived. And then to sort of catch up a bit, Leah gives a maidservant to Jacob called Zilpah. Okay, I don't know why that has to happen, unless it's just all part of the competition that's going on here. And then we get the next two children, who are, if you like, sort of Leah's, but not directly. So you get Gad, which means good fortune, I've got here. Or maybe also, I've got something else as well, but I think it's meant to do with luck and fortune. And then Asher, which means happy. So suddenly everybody's happy at that point. So we've now got how many? 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. There isn't a 4 to Leah. 2 more through Rachel's maidservant, 2 through Leah's maidservant. What happens next? I think we now get to the bit about the mandrakes, don't we? So because Leah suddenly seems to be not producing herself, she goes for some kind of herbal remedy, I suppose it would be. She's gone by a surrogacy to herbal therapies. Don't ask me what mandrakes really do. I have no idea, but anyway. It seems to work, I think, because who do we get next? Issachar and Zebulun. And these are back to coming from Leah. Issachar meaning reward. Zebulun meaning honour. I'm going to look these up, of course.
I've got something a bit different there for Zebulun.
This okay.
Living together.
Oh, okay. I've got the full thing is God bestowed upon me a good gift. This time my man will honour me. Is there's a fuller explanation from somewhere. But yeah. Okay, so now we've got children numbers where we've got to 9 and 10. We've also got somebody else sneaking in at this point. Just a little aside, that in the midst of all this, there's a daughter born as well, a little bit later, and she's called Dinah. Now, the only reason I think that we get to know about that here is that she's going to feature in a later chapter, isn't she, in a very unpleasant sort of story in Genesis 34. And then finally, we come back to Rachel. By the time we get to chapter 22. And now this lovely phrase, God remembered Rachel. And I've said time and again about this word remember. It isn't about suddenly coming to mind, like remembering something as opposed to forgetting. It's now God decides to act in a certain way. Now he wants Rachel to actually bear children of her own. And so she gives birth to Joseph, which means something like he may add, or God will add. And then eventually, finally, Benjamin. Where's Benjamin mentioned? Can't find him here. Where's is that not mentioned at this point? I've got to verse 20.
The only one that was born in the land.
Yeah, so it's not at this point, is it?
No.
No, we're going to have to wait, aren't we, sometime? Chapter 35. Yeah, a long, long time to go. Okay. Yeah. Yeah. That's right, because as we know, that's when she died, when she was giving birth to Benjamin. So that's some way off. But obviously, he's always included in the 12, the son of my right hand, and so on. And later, just to bear in mind, because they're going to become important, there's two more sons which are going to be reckoned as sons of Jacob eventually, and that's Ephraim and Manasseh, because they are going to be sons of Joseph. And later on, when the whole story unfolds, and everyone's reconciled and it's all sort of back to what it should be, then Ephraim and Manasseh, who were born, I think, to Joseph in Egypt, to an Egyptian wife, but they are going to become part of Jacob's, never Israel's, inheritance later on. So there you are. That's the order of production. And you can memorize them all and work out who came from who and in which order and so on if you want. So I think at this point we're going to pause. But Mary, do you want to say something now?
I just wanted to mention the fact that when Rebecca said, "Let your curse be on me, my son, only obey my voice and go and get them for me." And so she indeed was cursed because she never saw, after Jacob left, she died before he came back.
Right. Okay. Yeah. Thank
and
you.
That, you know, so indeed the curse did come on her.
Yeah. Yeah. Thank you. Okay. So we'll pause there for this week because just said that we'll pick it up for one more. Malcolm, next.
Yeah, just going back to Dinah in verse 21. Mine mm-hmm. says that Dinah means controversy over rights.
Ooh. Oh, okay. What funny names they give people. I mean, sometimes it's sort of like fairly obvious. Oh, the Lord has blessed me in this way, so I'll give him that name. But where on earth would that one come from, I wonder? Very strange.
I've got judgment in mind.
Okay.
Which is something similar.
Yeah. Well, when we pick it up next time, which will be the rest of, I don't think I've got my numbers right here, but we've got more trickery coming up, obviously with the flocks and so on, and then Jacob having to flee and so on. So next week, which is our last one, we will try and cover a bit more quickly perhaps a lot more of what actually happens to Jacob, including right at the very end. Obviously Joseph's story takes over, but Jacob comes back into it, and I wanted to really follow his role through in all this. Any final thoughts before we call it a day today?
You're a day.
Thank you. Well, that sounds like that's the end then, if I've been called a day. Shall we switch the recording off then before we get any more bad jokes or inappropriate?